This is the Rufus Project. It's free. It's like three podcasts for the price of one. Even though all three would still be free, never mind. You know what? We love bringing you this podcast for free, and we can keep doing that if it's a little bit of extra help from you as well. How can you help? So glad you asked. First up, find the Rufus Project on Twitter, on Facebook, on YouTube, on Ustream. Head to our homepage, therufusproject.podomatic.com, and share us on social media. The more people that find out, the more people that listen, the more follows we get, the more we can give you guys. Oh yeah. Don't want to share the entire thing? Maybe if we bring up something that you like or one of our competitions you think would appeal to others. Share us around for that reason. If you don't want to share and would like to give us something a little bit more substantial, if you head to that homepage, therufusproject.podomatic.com, you can hit the donate button and throw a few dollars our way. Want something material for your dollars? We've got you covered there too. We have a Spreadshirt store, therufusproject.spreadshirt.com.au. Here you can find a fine selection of men's, women's and kids' shirts with a grand total of one design, but you can pick your colour. We've also got the recent addition of the Rufus Project beverage dispenser. That's right, a coffee mug with our unofficial and public domain logo prominently on the side. You know you want it, go get it. Finally, yep, I'm going to pimp myself out. If you have a product or service that you would like us to talk about in this very advertising section that I'm putting in at the very front of the podcast, let us know. You can get in touch with us by email at rufusreviews.gmail.com. We definitely would love to hear from you, and we look forward to any support you can give us. Thanks a lot. Now on with this podcast. Hello and welcome to the Rufus Project, your fortnightly guide to all things geek, and believe us, we have a very broad definition of the word geek. I am your host, Trevor Holland, and I will be joined a little bit later on by my good friend and king of retro cinema in Brisbane, Christian Fletcher. So, if this is perhaps the first time you've listened to the Rufus Project, let me give you a quick rundown on what we do. We tend to start with the more traditional geek stuff. I'll give you a bit of a rundown on recent nerd-related news in gaming, movies, whatever, followed by a bit of a game chat. And this time we are going to look at some of the top games from 2014 that I had the luck and joy of experiencing. We then move on to our movie section. That's where we normally have a movie review. I got to see Big Hero 6. I'm very happy to tell you all about that. We normally have a bit of a retrospective or a bit of a look at a cult movie with Christian. Not this time around, but trust me, they will be back. And then we have our redeeming features section. This is where we take a famously, or perhaps infamously, bad movie and see if there are any redeeming features. For our first episode in 2015, though, we've had a look back at the movies that we have tried to redeem over the past year to try to work out if there are any that we were maybe a bit harsh in putting in this list in the first place, and find a few that basically are completely irredeemable. Finally, we move on to our local wildlife section. That's where we try to chat with people from all walks of life with all interests. This time around, we have the great pleasure in finally speaking to Crystal Ahrens. She's been a very, very hard person to track down and have a chat with. She's an actor, a director, a teacher, and a clown. So, a very interesting chat with her, and with the local wildlife, well, look, on the internet, we are all local. So, you know, it doesn't have to be an actual person from Australia. We have chatted with people overseas before. Following on from there, we tend to have a bit of a rundown of local events within the Brisbane area. And if you have anything that you would like us to talk about, you can always let us know. Finally, we do round out things with a competition, and Christian has got a great one lined up for you all this time. We'll quickly mention that if you stay tuned to the very, very, very end in fine Marvel movie tradition, there might be just something a little extra right at the very end. Anyway, that's enough of me rabbiting on telling you what the podcast is about. How about we just get on with the podcast? Enjoy. It was a bit difficult working out what to do with the news this time around. Should I look back at the biggest stories of last year? But then over the past couple of weeks, there's been more than enough to cover a full news segment. So that made the decision very, very easy for me. So let's get this underway, shall we? First up, our good friends at the Internet Archive, a lovely source of material and provide a lot of the public domain media that you hear in this very podcast. You may have remembered that a while ago we reported that they added a number of emulated console and arcade games for you to be able to play in your browser for free. Well, guess what? That collection is expanding. They've now added 2,400 MS-DOS games to play for free in your browser. There is everything from text adventures to graphic adventures, the original SimCity, and even the DOS version of Street Fighter 2. The collection is insane, and yes, you will lose a number of hours if you check it out. In other older school news, I guess, sales of music has been going down. CDs are on the way down. Digital music is actually on the way down after seeing an increase over the last couple of years, but all is not lost for the music industry, because there is still one form of media that is growing and growing and growing. In fact, this particular style had a 52% jump in sale from 2013 when you're looking at 2014. $9.2 million in sales of vinyl. Yes, the ultimate inconvenient format for music that everyone loves. I love it. I'm sure plenty of you guys out there love it too. Vinyl sales are still on the way up, so expect to see yet more of the whatever albums they can get their hands on to press on the black circle, so that they can charge you a huge amount for something that's been out for years. Oh, did my cynical side show there? Sorry about that, guys. Actually, no, I'm not sorry at all. It's also been quite an interesting time with regards to movies. A number of, I suppose, pretty big announcements have come through. First up, Tim Burton has confirmed that Winona Ryder is returning to reprise her role in Beetlejuice 2. Hopefully, they won't turn it into some ridiculous, over-the-top farce. But yes, I guess I am holding hope that Beetlejuice 2 can be something special. Not many details, but fingers crossed. Another great movie isn't so much getting a sequel, is actually being preserved. It's been deemed an important part of American cultural history and has been officially added to the National Film Preservation Board. That movie is The Big Lebowski. Because you know what? That rug really holds the room together, man. Now from the classics to something a bit more recent. If you've been keeping an eye on various social media over the past week, you will have noticed an interesting, if potentially annoying, promotion for a movie that is coming out in the not-too-distant future. It started when Marvel Studios released an ant-size teaser for Ant-Man. Well, actually, it wasn't so much for Ant-Man. It was a teaser trailer that you couldn't see because it was so small for a trailer. A couple of days later, they released the human-sized version of that teaser, which meant that the first one was actually a teaser for a teaser, but that was still a teaser for a trailer, which was finally shown during the first episode of Agent Carter over in the US. Now, I have seen the trailer, and it's piqued my interest. It does look pretty silly, but you know what? Marvel has pulled off taking a pretty silly concept and turning it into something awesome. Hello, Guardians of the Galaxy. But this whole teaser for a trailer? I mean, really, is that something that we want to keep seeing? Now, there is one person I know, quite funnily, who knows a bit about promotion and movies and the like. So I actually asked Christian his opinion on this particular topic.
Well, I don't know. I think what we're actually seeing, Trevor, is possibly the future of not maybe marketing as a whole, or film marketing, but when really they're just trying to test the waters with a lot of things. Like, look, the internet is so big with you know releasing these trailers and teasers and things like that, that I think Marvel are just going, you know, actually they're quivering in their boots, to be honest. After Guardians of the Galaxy went so well, they're probably, you know, this next thing has to be a big hit for them. So they're pulling out all the stops and trying whatever they can. And, hey, it might not work for them. It might annoy people having teasers upon teasers of teasers. But I definitely think it's quite quirky and different. And I think they need to be quirky in that and to keep up with the audiences, especially that the audience is coming through a lot younger too, that are, the people that are going to the movies too. Like, I think they've got to keep it quirky and kind of tap into that, I suppose, that tech-savvy audience. So I don't know, but you know, coming from a marketing background and a publicity background, when you're starving and you want things to sort of work out for you, you'll try all these different things. Not saying that Marvel is starving. I just believe that they're trying something very different, and hey, it could be the future of how movies and franchises are promoted.
Yeah, I guess that does make sense, but I think they're still pushing into crazy supervillain territory personally. Another big bit of news occurred around Netflix quite recently. After some updates to how it accesses the internet and sends information out, Netflix started using Google's DNS servers in order to, I suppose, try to provide a smoother experience for people. This caused a lot of problems for people accessing Netflix from areas that don't necessarily support it, which in turn started a massive, massive panic that Netflix was finally cracking down on those people who bypassed geographical restrictions to access their service, say, in places like, I don't know, Australia, which will be getting Netflix later this year. I didn't have that much problems personally, so I guess I took it with a grain of salt, and I'm thinking that, well, if I lose Netflix, I lose Netflix. What can I do? Well, a couple of days later, Netflix came out saying, we have done nothing, and we are not going out there targeting VPN or DNS spoofing services. You know, we just want to make sure that our users have a smooth experience. They then went on to say that in their terms of service, it does quite explicitly state that you should only be accessing the content available for your geographical location. And really, that they just wanted everyone to stop talking about this whole Netflix is cracking down on VPN services rubbish, and in fact wanted people to stop talking about VPN services altogether. Because, you know, the more people that talk about the VPN services, the more pressure gets put on Netflix to do something about it. So I'm kind of on their side with this one. Let's just keep it on the down low and we can all keep enjoying our access to Netflix for the foreseeable future. However, should us Aussies lose access to the US version of Netflix in the interim or when Netflix comes in officially into Australia, You know what? There is actually an alternative on the horizon that is surprisingly looking promising. Nine Network has joined forces with Fairfax Media to launch a streaming service called Stan. Yeah, great name, guys. And for $10 a month, they are actually offering a pretty impressive library of streaming content, which they promise will be available in full HD should your connection support it. So good luck with a lot of the connections out there, guys. I feel your pain, trust me. They have indicated that they intend to launch at the end of January. Now, I have put myself forward for a free trial, funnily enough, so should that actually happen, trust me, you'll be hearing all about it on the podcast. Oh, I suppose to compare, have that comparison to see how Stan in Australia compares to US Netflix. Because once you take the cost of, say, a VPN service or a DNS spoofing service into account, $10 a month is pretty good value. Watch this space. I will definitely keep you all updated. Now, to wrap up this little news segment, I just wanted to give a bit of news about Rufus Project shenanigans. Our YouTube channel, I'm going to work very, very hard at getting a lot more original content on there. I'll be doing a lot more Ustream live streaming of gameplay, which I will then be transferring across to the YouTube channel. So expect a lot more content there in 2015. And, you know, if you enjoy a nice beverage whilst watching these YouTube videos, head to our Spreadshirt store, therufusproject.spreadshirt.com.au, and get the Rufus Project beverage dispenser. It sounds great. It's really just a coffee mug with our logo on it. I can't think of anything better to drink out of whilst watching me play games. Okay? Excellent. That's enough news. Let's get on to the next bit. What better way to start a new year of gaming by looking back at the previous year of gaming? I thought I'd put together a little list of some of my favourite plays of 2014 and, you know, maybe hopefully you can get some inspiration and try some of these yourselves. This is not exhaustive, by the way, but like I said, mainly the games that I felt had something a little extra and really gave me that extra bit of enjoyment during playtime. I will start, I suppose, with some of the more dubious mentions. I don't mean that dodgy quality-wise. I did argue whether or not to include some of these games, but then I realised that one in particular was released on PS4 in 2014 and is one of my favourite games anyway, so if I had to include that, then the rest obviously must follow. So let's get started with Spelunky on PS4. I'm sure you saw it coming. This great little retro-style platformer with its wonderful gameplay of risk versus reward. It's addictive, it's frustrating, and it is just so rewarding when you get that good run going. Add to that the daily challenge to keep bringing you back just to see how high you can get on that leaderboard, and you've got a game that is going to keep you playing and playing and playing in quick bursts for a very long time. Since obviously we are talking about re-released games with extra features or better graphics, there's two more that really do stand out when you look specifically at the PlayStation 4. You have The Last of Us Remastered. Now, this game blitzed the Game of the Year awards for the PlayStation 3 when it was first released, and then the PS4 version came out, which included an extra content DLC called The Last of Us Left Behind. They worked mega on the graphics, they upped the frame rate, and it is a really wonderful experience playing this. And yes, it looks absolutely gorgeous. Another game that has benefited from a bit of a facelift is the also fun, yet somewhat controversial, GTA 5. The new generation version, I suppose I should also mention this on Xbox One as well, it does come through with those graphical enhancements. There's extra songs, there's extra content, and the first person mode that has been included really is a game changer. Completely changes the feel of the game and can make some of those driving sections a bit more challenging. Definitely worth revisiting, even if you have played it on, say, the Xbox 360 or the PlayStation 3. But how about we move on to some titles that were actually original in 2014? Well, quite early in the year, we were hit with another potentially controversial, very different, and surprisingly entertaining title. This was probably my biggest surprise of the year, and that was South Park: The Stick of Truth. Being a lapsed South Park fan, I was really expecting it to contain a lot of the stuff that pushed me away from South Park, but got there. Not only was it entertaining, not only was it funny, not only did it have gags that even old-time South Park fans can enjoy, it also turned out to be a surprisingly in-depth role-playing game. The combat system was quite creative, and of course just the scenarios and the situations your character gets put in, they can only really be described as South Park moments. Also, on the alternative role-playing game front, I'll probably just give a quick honourable mention to Child of Light, another side-scrolling role-playing game that does break up the normal conventions of this style of game quite a bit, again with quite a surprisingly in-depth but simple combat mechanic when you go into fights, if only it just wasn't so twee with its insistence of making all its dialogue rhyme. And after a while, it does get a bit gritty and samey. Nevertheless, though, it was a good effort, and it's even more surprising when you consider the team behind this were also some of the guys that worked on Far Cry 3. Now, from role-playing games to adventure games, The Walking Dead Season 2 came out this last 12 months, and absolutely one of the must-play titles of the year. With its engaging storyline, the impact of your decisions not always being felt immediately, and just some of the absolute gut-wrenching moments, really, it is what lifts this series up beyond just a simple point-and-click adventure. And on top of that, the fantastic voice cast, and you have a winner. This is a great experience, and like I said, one that really does go for the feels as well as that video game style excitement. Another honourable mention must go to The Wolf Amongst Us, which also comes from the Telltale stable of adventure games. Based on the Fables comic book series, and if you haven't read those, it's definitely worth checking out, this sees you take the role of Bigby, the sheriff of Fable Town, who is actually the big bad wolf. I won't go into the whole Fables mythology, we'll be here all night, but what starts off as a slow burner soon turns into a very compelling detective mystery game. And again, plenty of gruesome moments to keep you going. Well worth a look. But what would be the game of the year out of what I've played? Well, that is always a tough choice, but this time I've got to give the title to Dragon Age Inquisition. Not only does it have that great story that gets you straight in there and moves you forward, the fact that you can actually work against this character that you're meant to be portraying and that everybody else in the game thinks you are, and you can actively deny it, that itself sets this game apart right from the very, very start. add to that its absolute massive scope. I am still nowhere near finishing this thing. I just keep getting lost in the game world because I'm one of those people that cannot go past a quest marker without checking it out. It's slowing me down, but there's no doubt that I am really getting value for money from this title. Again, fantastic performances from the voice cast, and it really is just another wonderfully epic role-playing game from BioWare. This is a company that has a very strong pedigree in the style of games. It really does show, and this is truly the pinnacle of their work so far. So if you get no other games from 2014, go for Dragon Age Inquisition. It is just massive! And massively fun, which counts as well. So what are your thoughts of the best games of 2014? Well, definitely let us know if you agree with me, if you disagree with me, or if you have some suggestions of games that I should try that I may have missed over the past 12 months. Let me know via all the usual methods, which of course I will be letting you know at the end of the podcast. In the meantime though, happy gaming for 2015. So we have another holiday period that has been and gone, and of course we've seen the release of another Disney movie to take advantage of said holiday period. Of course it was delayed in Australia, but not long after its release in Australia I did have the fortune to go along and see Big Hero 6 with the rest of the family. If you haven't heard yet, Big Hero 6 is essentially a story of a boy, a genius, who teams up with a bunch of other geniuses and a robot named Baymax. What you may not know is that Big Hero 6 is actually a comic book movie. Yep, this comes from a comic book, and it's a Marvel comic book. As you may or may not know, Marvel and Disney have joined forces, and essentially all the Avenger-related movies are Marvel movie and Disney movies, but Marvel's front and center. In this particular case, Disney stays front and center. We don't see the Marvel logo at the start, but there are a few things in there that show you that it is still at heart a Marvel comic book movie. I will get back to those in a minute, but anyway, back to the main details of this particular movie. The hero of the piece, a character named Hero, played by Ryan Potter, is a bit of a misguided youth. He is a genius, he makes his own robots, he's very, very clever, and he, shall we say, partakes in activities that his elder brother, Tadashi, does not approve of. Long story short, Tadashi convinces Hero to apply to this university to make better use of his skills. Things go a bit pear-shaped. Hero needs to team up with all of Tadashi's friends and also a robot developed by Tadashi known as Baymax, played by Scott Adsit. And Baymax, if you have not seen the trailers, he really is the star of the show. The performance and the animation of this gentle robot that is put in this very strange situation is absolutely charming, and you cannot help but get engaged with this thing. It really is quite spectacular and goes a fair way to a bit of genius. For a movie to have myself, my wife, and my two kids, who've got a bit of an age difference between them, and had them all engaged and enjoying this movie, is quite an achievement. Beyond that, it's a bit hard to tell you much more about the movie itself. What it does do, though, is sets up what you think is going to be the progression of the movie, takes a bit of a left turn about halfway through, which is very cleverly done. And what it really does is, even with the bad guy, really sets up the motivation for why they're doing what they're doing. they're not just some villainous person who's just out to do no good because they're evil. There is an actual reason and an understandable reason behind this guy's motivations. Again, which is very, very impressive for the style of movie. Now, even though it is a delight for all ages and it has many, many moments that everyone will be laughing at, I do need to put in a little word of warning that there are some scenes that get a bit on the serious side and do deal with some pretty dark topics. So be warned. Younger viewers may be upset by some of the goings on, and perhaps even some slightly older kids, you may have to have some conversations afterwards that could not be entirely comfortable. You have been warned, this does go some dark places. This is definitely worth seeing at the cinema, and if you do see it at the cinema, as per Disney tradition, there is also a short film before the movie starts. This one's called Feast, and yet again, it is an absolutely charming, unconventional tale. If you saw Paper Man before Wreck-It Ralph, you can just see how artistic these short films can be. Feast is almost up there on a par with Paper Man. It was absolutely wonderful. Now, touching back on that connection with Marvel, let's just say there is a certain Marvel bigwig who makes a cameo appearance in this movie, as he does in any of the Marvel movies, whether they're made by Marvel/Disney Studios, or Sony, or Fox, there is always an appearance by this guy in the movies somewhere. And it's always fun, you know, spotting him when he turns up. And also, at the end of the credits, there is an end credit scene. So you've got to sit all the way through, and right at the end, there's a little bit extra to reward you for your patience. And it actually is pretty good sitting around and waiting for that one. Won't go further into that, of course. Yeah, but definitely sit through right to the very, very end. So in summary, if you still haven't caught up with the holiday movies, Big Hero 6 is definitely worth visiting at the cinema. And it is good fun for all ages. But again, be warned, there are some dark segments that deal with some pretty serious issues. So just maybe something to research a little more if you do have younger viewers you're intending to take.
I would like to help. Scan complete. You are experiencing mood swings. Diagnosis? Puberty.
Whoa, what?
As we may have mentioned already a few times in this podcast, it is a brand new year, and again, what better way to face a brand new year than to have a look back at the year that was just gone. And I think one of the more interesting aspects of the past year and the podcast that we have done would have to be this redeeming features section. Now, we do have our first Redeeming Features movie lined up, which is for next podcast, but we thought, to start out, we'd have a little look back at what we have watched and what we have experienced, for better or for worse, and work out if any of them were redeemable. Were we a bit harsh in lumping some of them in this section? And, of course, what is beyond redemption and should just never be spoken of again. Thankfully, I'm not alone in this task. I am, again, joined by Christian. Christian, how are you this evening?
Great, thank you, Trevor, and Happy New Year to you and the Rufus Project listeners. So absolutely. I'm glad we haven't scared them off with our 2014 movie choices, and you've decided to tune in this year. So I'm really actually excited / interested to see you know what we can come up with, because looking through this list, wow, Trevor, I don't know if I just kind of had a memory lapse or purposely blocked it from my memory, but a lot of these movies I'd forgotten we'd covered, and a lot of them too. I feel too, like I do a lot of programming for cinemas, especially trash movie night. And a lot of these movies I'm looking at this list shouldn't even be anywhere near being the worst films of all time. So maybe we were a bit harsh, Trevor, but hey, it's always good to look back on these things in hindsight and, yeah, and appreciate them possibly in a different way. But yeah, so how should we start this?
Well, I guess, fun enough, we did discuss this briefly before starting this recording, and I understand that you, I suppose you have grouped them. So if perhaps we can go through and look at the groupings and have a bit of chat about those as we go before we're trying to work out, which are worthy to be watched again and which one that should be buried under a very deep pile of muck.
Oh, definitely. And I almost think, Trevor, we almost need to throw in a third column there, ones where we almost, we're very indecisive between the two of us. And, like, there might be a movie that I kind of, it's kind of a guilty pleasure of mine where you kind of don't see the the appeal.
I wonder.
And I'm looking through the list going, yes, and I'm even thinking, should I mention that I even like them? Which it seems almost fitting. Why don't I lead in? The first genre I've got is camp. And it's probably not the best genre to use. I probably just should have said 80s musicals. But two movie musicals that stood out as being included in the redeeming features were two 1980 movies, Can't Stop the Music and Xanadu, almost a double feature in the making there. But looking back at that, you know, they're two movies that I'm so familiar with, so almost they're almost I can see their flaws, but I can also see past them. So it was really interesting being able, because I believe when we did Can't Stop the Music, it was a group discussion with a few of us. So it was interesting being able to hear the different points of view about it. A film that I was just so familiar with. You know, when you're so familiar with these movies that they're above sort of criticism because you're just so familiar and so used to the things happening in it. So I would happily get Can't Stop the Music and Xanadu out of my DVD shelf. And yes, they are both in there. So that sort of shows where we possibly contrast a bit, Trevor.
Quite possibly. I've got to admit, Can't Stop the Music, considering that we then had to go on and have a performance, put together the little Village People, I suppose, tribute group to do a bit of lip syncing and a bit of dancing to both the movie and in front of a trivia night. That was definitely an experience. It has given me some pretty fond feelings towards that particular movie, even though I could probably go quite some time without hearing the Milkshake song again.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah, but I certainly can't stand with you there on Xanadu. If I remember correctly, we did talk quite extensively how there were, callbacks and almost tributes to, like, the old Gene Kelly movies. And I think really the best outcome to have that sort of experience is be just watch the old Gene Kelly movies and skip this piece of neon lit tripe entirely.
Well, it was interesting because I think I think as we were speaking in that podcast, you weren't too familiar with the sort of background with the Gene Kelly connection, that it was actually, I suppose, Xanadu was a sequel to a 40s movie, if you wanted to look at it like a sequel to the character. So I suppose that would have sort of given you a whole new spin on it, because really, Trevor, if you are seeing it, yeah, with any, you know, not even thinking of any sort of background or any sort of connection to the yesteryear, you'd just be going, what the hell? So it did kind of, I suppose it did kind of enlighten you a bit and give you a bit more of a, I don't know, purpose to the movie. Still, its existence is debatable. Hey, it's even been recently adapted into a stage show too, where they take the Mickey out of it. So that just shows sort of, I suppose, how people affectionately think about it. And hey, everyone that I know that's obsessed or loves Xanadu, you know, they love it because it's so bad. But even saying that's so awful, you know what I mean? So bad it's good, dare I say it. So yeah, no, they were two very interesting ones. But, speaking of, you know, the 80s, and I'm noticing a bit of a trend here, but going into possibly one of my, I don't think you could call this a movie genre, but possibly one of my most fascinating, a fascinating area of film for me, which is the sequel. Now, I'm looking through our list, Trevor, and there has been probably six or more movies in the year that were actually sequels, or possibly a continuation of a franchise, I suppose you could say. And I'm going to kick off and move straight off from Can't Stop the Music and Xanadu with Shock Treatment from 1981, the Rocky Horror, inverted commas, sequel. And that was really interesting to re-explore because Trevor and I having the background with Rocky Horror and, you know, always having that movie around us. But I think you've always been a bit wary of it, Trevor, whereas I've sort of, I think, always had a soft spot for Shock Treatment.
Yeah, I do remember, like, it took me quite a bit to get into it. And I think having the barrier of having to get past Barry Humphries and his performance in this movie, it just really rubbed me the wrong way. But I will happily admit that when I rewatched this for the intention of the redeeming features, I did find quite a lot that I liked, and I really did find myself enjoying a lot of the songs and really getting into it more. So, you know what? I'm a bit of a convert to this one after rewatching it. It's still nowhere near as good as Rocky Horror.
Oh, nothing could be. Yeah,
but it certainly, as its own standalone movie, you know what? I think it's redeemable, and I probably, if it does come up as a double feature, I may actually stick around for part two of that double feature next time around.
And hey, since recording that podcast about Shock Treatment, as Richard O'Brien has announced a stage production that's opening in March in the UK. So I think things do come full circle. You know, fans and Richard himself have dissed the movies for a lot of years. Rocky Horror fans, I mean. And so it's interesting it's come full circle, and they've realised it was actually quite ahead of its time, being, you know, very much about reality television. But listen back to a previous podcast to hear all that speak of that. But going in, just, I know we don't want to talk about every movie, Trevor, but I can't resist mentioning Grease 2 from 1982. Moving on from Shock Treatment the year following. Now, I'll probably get a slap on the head from a lot of people, but I'm a bit of a fan of Grease 2. And I think it stemmed from, I had the video when I was a kid, and whilst I knew Grease 2 became the one that I ended up seeing quite a lot of, to the point of when we were doing the original Grease floor show, I got so confused by half the dialogue and realising, hang on, that's not even in that movie. So that made me realise how much I had actually seen Grease 2, but I know that a lot of people aren't fans.
It does not seem like a sequel that needed to exist. It just tried too hard to be bigger and wilder and just more over the top, and it kind of just wallows in its excess. And yeah, it just doesn't have that fun feel of the original Grease. It just tries too hard. It has so much sexual innuendo within its songs, and I don't know. I know it's trying to push the limits, trying to push the boundaries, and trying to go one better, but it kind of just trips and falls on its face for me.
Oh well, we'll have to agree to disagree, Trevor. Because from my angle, we know Grease to death. The songs are so ingrained in us. Not that that's a bad thing, but to me, seeing Grease 2 is so refreshing because it's something that it's something that we're not as familiar with. And I think that's kind of how I feel with Shock Treatment 2. What's almost like, I almost feel sorry for sequels, and Grease 2 is definitely probably the one at the top of the pile as being probably one that I believe is better than the original. Shoot me now. We can move on.
Each to their own.
So we will agree to disagree, Trevor. Yep. Not that I can back myself up if I'm ever have to do this publicly and people say, how could you like that movie? I always seem to end up cornering, getting knocked into a corner. So, but yeah, no, I'll happily state that it's one of my guilty pleasures and probably my number one guilty pleasure.
No, that's fine.
But yeah, so now I know we did deal a lot. You know, there's a few other sequels. We did Troll 2 and Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 3, and any of those stand out as being worth mentioning?
I don't know. Troll 2, it's a difficult one for me. I know it's horrible, and I know that watching it really wasn't that good of experience, but it just had these occasional moments that just shone through of just complete ridiculousness that kept you going. So for something that you repeatedly almost want to turn off on a number of occasions and then it just pulls you back in, that's an achievement. I'm going to give it a little gold star for that, for effort.
It's entertainingly bad in a good way. And I know a lot of these movies seem to be lumped with that. But actually, since we recorded the podcast, I've watched Troll number one, which they've always said, I've always read over the years that, you know, they've said that it's nothing to do with the first movie and it's so much better. But honestly, I was so surprised at how much the two were very, very similar. So I think it was unfairly treated because really the first one's just as bad.
Right. But the first one had, oh my God.
some of the best dialogue in a motion picture. But and then we tackled Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 3, which to me, alongside a lot of the other movies we did, was very meh. That's probably the only thing I can really sum that up with, thinking back to it, is meh, it just exists. That's kind of all I can really say about it.
Yeah, it's not the worst movie we watched. Certainly not the best movie we watched. It's just kind of like, it's a movie. Yeah, watch it if you're interested. If not, pass it by.
Definitely. And I think that you really should have stopped at the second one. And even then, the second one was almost sort of, it's enjoyable, but even then, that's sort of cutting the bottom, you know, digging the bottom of the barrel. So,
but if it wasn't for number two, we wouldn't have Vanilla Ice's Ninja Rap.
Oh, definitely. And we wouldn't have been able to give Vanilla Ice his early 90s movie career, which these movies seem to do. But they were definitely... definitely interesting movies with the sequels. But I noticed, Trevor, and I don't know if this is, you know, definitely the feel of the podcast, but also you being a bit of a video gamer, we had a bit of a, I'm noticing a bit of a video game, especially 90s video game movie adaptation theme going through the podcast last year.
Yeah, they really did push these video game to movie adaptations in the 90s. It just was like an avalanche of them, of largely dubious quality. It just seemed to be the time. I suppose people were looking for new ideas rather than now, where they seem to be looking at previous ideas and redoing them. And obviously it was a time, I suppose, when video games were really coming to the fore. I mean, you had games like Mortal Kombat causing controversy, and also there was Night Trap, which was also quite controversial in its time. So I suppose the media attention of these games, even though it definitely wasn't positive media attention in a lot of the cases, I suppose burned the Hollywood producers into actually trying to cash in on that interest. And look at the results we got.
Oh, definitely. And like, I know that we, I know you did Mortal Kombat. I wasn't involved in that podcast, but I haven't to this day, still haven't seen it. So, but I know that, don't know if you made me watch these is probably the right terminology, but Super Mario Brothers and Double Dragon. And I've actually, I'm both from 1993, interestingly. Super Mario Brothers, you know, I'm a fan of the game and I had seen the movie a few times in the past, but being able to revisit it was interesting. And I definitely think it tried so hard, but dare I say it is, Double Dragon really was the one that surprised me. I felt that felt more what a video game adaptation of the 90s should have felt like. There was all these little in-jokes about gaming and Trevor, it's been so long, I probably can't even remember half the references. But I just know that even though Super Mario Brothers, you know, it's enjoyable and almost very kitschy for the 90s, I suppose, Double Dragon succeeded to me as being possibly one of the best video game adaptations of the period, or of what we've watched, because, I don't know, it just was very tongue-in-cheek and very aware that, hey, we're adapting a video game and this may not work. I don't know, that was the feeling. But from memory, I don't think you were a big fan of Double Dragon. I think I remember this being a bit of a disagreement.
Yeah, Double Dragon, just with the very, very poor acting, and it even did have a few big names in there, which I think is, when you have a bad movie with actors in there who you know can do better, it just really drags it down even further.
I know, it makes it almost more enjoyable, and it's interesting because you see, I you know, you'd even see it in with bad movies when they use actors and they in the bargain bins at like the Crazy Clarks or something like that, and they'll have, you know, starring such and such, you know, before they were even famous, and then, you know, the movies they want them to forget about. And a lot of these too would have been actors that are just desperate for the money, not caring about the result. And there's been quite a few of those too. Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Yes. Well, I know there's one video translation that you haven't watched, and I have mentioned it a few times, but I think the grand prize for the biggest names in a horrible movie just not wanting to be there would have to be good old Blood Rain.
Oh, God, yeah. I almost feel like you're championing it every time you're talking about it, even though I realise you're actually bagging out, because we hear about Blood Rain so much that it must be bloody bad. Because listeners, Trevor still hasn't made me watch it yet, so...
No.
But we'll have to keep that to a little bit later, because I'm assuming that would be one of your most irredeemable movies.
Yeah, potentially.
potentially.
But I know that, but it was interesting, but, you know, looking at, I suppose, I think it was the three, Mortal Kombat, Super Mario Brothers, and Double Dragon, what would you say was the best out of those three, the ones that was, you know, you were ended up being surprised about, or happy with?
Well, Mortal Kombat, you're saying Grease 2 was your guilty pleasure, Mortal Kombat is one of mine. Just with its dodgy martial arts action, which ranges between people actually going extra carefully slow and then actually speeded up footage.
That's awesome.
One of the bad guys in it, by the name of Goro, was in the video games, this giant four-armed creature. And for when it was made, the effects for him, and the fact that they actually did manage to pull off semi-convincing fight scenes with this model in this movie, it is impressive, and I've got to give them points for that. And then, of course, there's also Christopher Lambert's wig, which could well have started a spin-off of its own. It was just remarkable.
And it sounds like that spin-off still would have been better than some of the other video game adaptations.
Yeah, pretty much.
Oh, it's good to know, Trevor. I'll look to say, if listeners ever came to a Rufus project double feature, imagine us doing Grease 2 and Mortal Kombat. What an interesting double that would be. About guilty pleasures.
Yep. Oh, that'd be interesting. Yeah. A Rufus Project Guilty Pleasures night. Wouldn't that be an amazing experience?
And if we could find ways to tie in the two movies, I'm sure I could. But interesting, we still I've noticed a lot of these movies are very much to the 90s. We haven't really gone back too far, which is good, you know. But a sort of genre that I've noticed sort of come up a bit in the Rufus Project is the whole concept of the creature feature or the monster movie. And by those movies, I'm sort of meaning, you know, Attack of the 50-Foot Woman, Godzilla, Attack of the Killer Tomatoes. I suppose, you know, they're very loosely fit into those genres, but they're probably our most sort of retro ones, with the exception of Godzilla. But I actually, just looking through my list here, you probably agree, Trevor, the one that I was probably most pleasantly surprised with was Attack of the 50-Foot Woman. It wasn't some B-grade 50s stinker that the title almost suggests.
Yeah, absolutely. It was a nice movie, nicely put together. A lot of the laughs, I guess, you could have at it is just really from the fact that the language has changed so much since it was made. We're talking back in 1958 here. Mm. And it also had the wonderful, and I found very refreshing, fact that it didn't outstay its welcome. It told its story. It got to the end. That was it. There was just no fluff, no filler, no embellishment that, you know, was trying to drag it out to a longer length.
Well, interestingly, Trevor, since we did the podcast, I remember mentioning that there is a 1993 version with Daryl Hannah playing the lead role, and I actually have seen it since we did the podcast, and that is the perfect example of getting that same plot and padding it out. You know, nice. It was an hour and a half, and it just felt so long. There were all these extra scenes of the giant Nancy, I believe the name was, in the spa having a conversation with her midget, or small husband. And I just felt that it was just so much filler, and you almost pined for the 1958 version. It almost felt like this was the director's cut you were watching, and whereas the 50s one felt that, you know, you fit it in so much better. So it just goes to show that you can't really beat the original in that sort of case. But probably one that, you know, definitely isn't original, and I suppose more a remake than a sequel, is Godzilla from 1998. Now, I don't think I hated it as much as I thought I would. In many ways, it was taking the concept of Godzilla and taking it to a totally new realm. Because I think we worked out, look, honestly, Trevor, it's been so long now since I've seen it, I can't even remember the names, but they had the spin-off. They almost were their own creatures. The Zillas, was it, or something to do with, look, I'm drawing a blank.
Yeah, the baby Godzillas.
Yeah. So in many ways, I think we sort of worked out that we aren't essentially watching, I suppose, a big screen adaptation of the Godzilla story that we really know. It sort of took it to a whole new realm and sort of became kind of took it into merchandising kind of territory and sort of, you know, how can we sell these characters? And but wasn't as bad as it could have been, I believe.
Well, yeah, for a movie that floundered for quite some time, when you get to the actual action of it, Matthew Broderick Ferris Bueller, trying to escape from a horde of hungry baby Godzillas. It is actually exciting and fun to watch for that particular period that it just falls down again at the end. But, you know, it does have this solid core of action that you can really get into. And again, that is quite surprising, considering the movie in question.
Oh, just it did have two, like we mentioned, had those moments, you know, but it was almost too little too late. Like, I remember that even that scene in, you know, with the baby Godzillas was, you know, almost past the halfway mark of this two and a half hour movie. You know, they were trying to, there were too many lulls, and they were trying to throw in all this sort of love interest and these female characters that never really went anywhere.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think in the case of almost, I suppose, with Attack of the 50-Foot Woman, you know, Godzilla should have learnt from them where make it short and simple. You don't have to focus on all this backstory. We just want to see the action, especially with a movie like this. But another sort of, well, I don't know, I'm actually going to speak about this a bit later as being irredeemable, so I won't mention this one yet, but I know there's a bit of a sci-fi theme, Trev, and I don't know if lumping Space Jam in with this is a good idea, but I've got Space Jam and Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy was sort of our, you know, that I looked at with you, our sort of sci-fi angle. So, yeah, that was an interesting one. I remember Hitchhiker's definitely brought out some interesting facts, especially you being more familiar with the book.
Yeah, Hitchhiker's such an earnest attempt of bringing what is essentially a cult book and cult TV series to a mainstream audience. Earnest attempt, didn't succeed, but again, I am willing to give them points for trying.
Oh, definitely. Look, they've tried so hard, and there's so many, you know, from someone coming from the angle of not knowing the books, and you know, you had to enlighten me on quite a lot. You know, I can see what they were trying to get at, and I can understand, you know, and they created this fantastic, they created their own world so well, but I believe that would have been, you know, 99% of the original, the author, I'm sure. But they just did a good, very good job of translating it, I suppose, for the time. It'd be interesting to see what they'd do now, even though it's only been 10 years, you know, would they be more technologically advanced to be able to, I don't know, make the story better or make it work as a movie? But, you know, it, as you said, it was a real sleeper cult hit. And but, yeah, no, it didn't grab me too much, but I can see its appeal.
Yeah. Ultimately, again, another one that fell down, and I suppose this is probably one that I have that extra level of disappointment, obviously, being the fan, wanting to see the story done justice, and the fact that they, again, were trying to please the mainstream as well as the core Hitchhiker's fans, and that's where it came undone, really.
Yeah, I get that feeling too, but... And it's interesting because I suppose going off from that, I don't know if, you know, we need to talk about this too much, but we also looked at sort of a bit of Star Wars territory.
Indeed we did.
Phantom Menace, and I suppose you could say the holiday special. We just spoke about oh my God, I can't believe this exists. I need to talk to someone sort of situation last year. So, but you know, look, honestly, I actually, Trevor, you'll appreciate this. I saw a gentleman today with a shirt with the logo, you know, the same shape as the Star Wars logo, and it said, "Tell me on the trilogy where George touched you or hurt you," you know, almost to say, you know, you get what I mean, Trev. Yeah, yeah. I'll have to find I find an image of it on the internet and send it to you. But it took me a while to sort of get it, and yes. And, it, you know, in many ways, the first thing I thought was The Phantom Menace, because I believe that would have been a lot of what people thought. It was almost taking your childhood and bringing it into the 90s.
Yeah, a terrible, terrible prequel that, when you look at the overall story arc of Star Wars, doesn't actually need to exist, and questionable whether it should exist. But saying that, it is still a magnitude better experience than the horrible, horrible, as my son said, terrible, horrible Star Wars Holiday Special.
Funny you should say that, though, Trev, because I would happily watch the Holiday Special over Phantom Menace any time.
Ooh.
Yeah, I know. That I just said that in a recording. But I do believe it's because there's even though the Holiday Special is so bad. Look, this is coming from a non-Star Wars fan here, so both things to me, you know, go over my head anyway. But at least the holiday special has that sort of, you know, I love that sort of so bad it's good, dare I say, you know, that kind of camp value. So I suppose there was always something to sort of enjoy with the holiday special, even though it was a lot of, you know, things that I didn't enjoy, you know, a lot of Wookiees and things like that. So, but I definitely found it a lot more enjoyable. Otherwise, just watching The Phantom Menace was just, I'd entered a world I knew nothing about. But from the sounds of it, even fans were thinking the same thing.
The Phantom Menace could be improved by taking out about 90% of the completely irrelevant, annoying stuff, starting with Jar Jar and working from there.
He'd probably rank as probably the one of the most annoying characters of all time, just from what I hear in movie history and I suppose what fans say. So, I could see how him not being in there would be a good thing. But definitely those Star Wars things, those two, ouch. Yeah. That's a double feature we will not be screening.
No. I would not go to that one, even if I...
I wouldn't even bother trying to get the rights from George Lucas, because I know what it'll say.
Yeah, people say, no.
But there was, there's probably a few more, Trevor, but, you know, let me feel free to interject, but I know that one movie that you reviewed, but I saw subsequently at a screening, was Hercules in New York from 1969, which was Arnold Schwarzenegger's first movie. Now, having heard you speak about it, Trevor, and then watching it with an audience, it was such a great experience. So anyone who's listening that has done that based on our podcast, I can see what you mean. Like, it's really great to be able to sort of, you know, take up that on board and being able to hear people laughing at the different spots. And I found it very enjoyably bad, but I can see why it wouldn't be one that he'd be pushing too much to be screened in public very often.
No, it's one of those oddities. I do need to ask you, though, with the version you saw, was it Arnie real or Arnie dubbed?
No, it was Arnie original, Arnie real. So I didn't. However, people at the screenings were saying to me that they are familiar with the version which is dubbed over by that really bad American accent. So we were lucky enough to be able to hear the original audio, but a lot of audiences haven't been quite so lucky.
Yeah, it is actually. I do think it is better with the with Arnie as Arnie, because that American voiceover that gets dubbed on is just cheesy radio announcer, and that does not work well with Hercules. Neither does Arnie, but Arnie at least works slightly better.
Oh, you know, and it's almost like, you know, this is a bit, you know, a historical artifact, this movie, technically. It's gone based on, you know, his career, after that. So really to have altered it was quite strange anyway, so at least we can appreciate it with the original inflections. I'm glad they didn't get rid of that audio and permanently dub over the American. That would have been quite annoying.
Yeah. Definitely. It's an oddity. I don't really know where to put it on the scale of should it be seen or should it be swept under the rug. It's a bad, bad movie where they make lots of bad, bad choices and terrible, terrible acting. But again, it's Arnie's first movie, so it does have some merit in being visited.
Oh, definitely. And like recently at the Globe, we screened Pumping Iron, the Arnold Schwarzenegger bodybuilding doco from the late 70s. And it's interesting. I think I could easily pair it with Hercules in New York as a bit of an oddity double feature, because, you know, there's interest there. And there's so many bodybuilding scenes in Hercules in New York. It's just a shame they had to try and, well, actually not a shame, but it's funny that they made this plot around it involving Hercules. It was obviously filmed in Central Park.
Yeah. So much so you could hear the traffic noise.
Ugh. Oh, definitely. Definitely, I suppose for some people could be a guilty pleasure. So I definitely wouldn't say don't watch it, but interesting to hear what people's thoughts would be about that. But so, yeah, so now I've got, a couple of titles that we have mentioned, you know, sort of what I thought, you know, maybe ones that were unfair to, ones that are irredeemable, but there's probably other things that you can think of, Trevor, that I might have overlooked title-wise.
Yeah, well, again, one that I suppose has become a bit more relevant given a more recent movie release, and I know you haven't seen this one, so I do apologise. But it would be 1986 Howard the Duck. This movie, again, George Lucas showing the same sort of form that we would not be seeing again to The Phantom Menace. Is an oddity in itself in that it is probably the first time a obscure Marvel character was brought to the big screen. And the reason that ties in, and I do apologize if you haven't seen this yet, but I'm about to spoil the end credit scene of Guardians of the Galaxy, where they have Howard the Duck come back. And it's almost like Marvel going, you have just witnessed our greatest triumph of obscure comic book characters, and you know what? We acknowledge the fact that our first attempt was this horrible Howard the Duck. And
that's pretty cool.
It's kind of like, yeah, kind of like a bookend. So, again, I would have to say, don't watch Howard the Duck. And unless you really, really, really want to know what that end credit scene of Guardians of the Galaxy actually means.
And that would be a lot of desperation, though, as you're saying, to really actually watch Howard the Duck. And I've only got about halfway through it. I've never watched the entire thing, and that probably says a lot, too.
Oh, but, that means you've missed the wonderful song that Tia Leone sings at the end.
Oh, gosh, it sounds like I am missing out.
yeah, YouTube it sometime.
Ouch, okay. But no, definitely, I forgot about good old Howard, so. But there's, you know, we've mentioned a few, you know, that, as I said, that proved a revelation. God, definitely, just going through this list, I was so surprised of Double Dragon. I enjoyed it more than I thought I would. Believe it or not, this has made it to my list. And Grease 2, which I'll happily stick up for any time, as a movie that we were quite unfair to. But I do agree that Trevor's not a fan, so that makes sense. Definitely, I suppose one of the ones that seems to be coming up as quite a revelation is Attack of the 50-Foot Woman. That's almost been relegated, so why is this in this list?
Well, I was going to ask you, to say three of these that you think should not be in the list, and you've already covered them over perfectly.
Well, yeah, definitely. So ones that I think, should definitely, well, you know, I haven't got an extra title to, but basically pretty much ones that were unfair to or ones that proved a revelation were Double Dragon, Attack of the 50-Foot Woman, Grease 2, and, believe it or not, Space Jam. Because I believe, you know, hey, it exists, it doesn't do anything bad or necessarily fantastic, but it's a great, I suppose, even a Saturday afternoon, a movie for the family. So I think Space Jam was also probably unfairly treated because it was so of its time. You know, it was so of 1996 when when basketball was so huge. And, it was quite cutting edge with technology in the wake of Who Framed Roger Rabbit. So, but what about yourself, Trevor? Any three that you think that we were very cruel to in the interim?
Well, I mean, again, definitely top of the should-not-be-here list is Attack of the 50-Foot Woman. That is a science fiction classic, and yes, it should be celebrated. Beyond that, it starts getting a bit more difficult. I mean, Space Jam was pretty uneven, and there were certainly plenty of scenes in there which dragged on far too long. But again, like you said, it was quite a technical achievement for its time. Mm. And it really was quite enjoyable and a good bit of silly fun. And I guess... And there's going to be a lot of people that know me that will be surprised to hear me to say this, but I really think that that shock treatment, I have actually been treating it unfairly for years, and I'm now going to officially say I have been converted.
Oh, Trevor, I never thought I'd hear you say that. It's definitely a movie that I think, you know, I suppose like Rocky Horror for a lot of people, even though shock treatment takes longer to grow on you, but yeah, definitely it's a movie that grows on you, and how can you resist those songs, even though some of them are very daggy and very 80s. Hey, it's an 80s movie, and I think Shock Treatment has just been, I think, unfairly lumped with the sequel title all these years, and it really just should be seen as a standalone, you know, and almost a preempting reality television 20 years before the fact, you know, and commenting on it, on commercialism in America. So, yeah, I'm glad that you've seen the light.
I have. I definitely have.
Not the light I thought you'd see, but I'm glad it was
clear. And I suppose, I guess, in amongst this list, just give us a few little titles that, I suppose, caused you so much pain that you wish you never experienced them in the first place.
There's one title here that's probably stuck out to me as the most irredeemable. And look, Trevor, I never thought I'd say this movie. It's something that I suppose by doing the podcast, it made me go back and consider it again and look at it in a different sort of way. And I remember you watching it. I remember your wife also watching it as well. And it's a movie called Attack of the Killer Tomatoes from 1978, lumped in with the monster movie category. Now, I never thought I'd say this, but yeah, Trevor, it almost was irredeemable. It went beyond its, I know we had this discussion, you know, it was almost too aware of it was trying to be a cult movie or trying to be a tongue-in-cheek spoof that it just comes across really daggy and bad. But that said, you know, I'll still happily screen it and I'll still sit in there and watch it and have a giggle here and there. But really, it just doesn't sit well, does it? And I don't know. I think doing this podcast has made me sort of think about Killer Tomatoes in a whole new light, because it really doesn't live up to what the title could have been as this really awesome spoof.
Yeah, I don't think it's aged very well either.
Oh, that's it. You know, and you know, I love the 70s, as everyone knows, but I can even watch and go, ooh, you know. And it's also been the fact, too, that it hasn't been remastered or it hasn't really got a big company behind it. So, you know, you're never really seeing a very polished version of the film. And the only polished versions were whenever they did the sequels. But, yeah, I don't know. It never really does sit well with me. And whenever I do screen it, you get – this is a bit of a – I suppose a publicity 101, but you're using the title to try and get people in. Oh, wow, Attack of the Killer Tomatoes. This is going to be great. Is this going to be like all your other Attack of the 50-Foot Woman? And you, to be honest, I see audiences leaving being quite disappointed that the movie really doesn't live up to the reputation that it suggests. So I definitely think Attack of the Killer Tomatoes would be the one that I've had to re-look at and say, yeah, it kind of is irredeemable. But if you enjoy that kind of thing, it works perfectly for that. So I think, I don't know, it's a, yeah, that's probably my thoughts on that one.
Well, I don't think it's going to be any mystery that the movie that I regretted watching the most, you have people like Michael Madsen, Meatloaf, Billy Zane, Ben Kingsley of all people, putting in performances that are just so wooden and terrible because they don't want to be there, is what really takes Blood Rain to an unbelievably awful level. There is just simply nothing good to say about this movie, and I still feel guilty in trying to get other people to try to give other people reasons to watch it, because there is no reason to watch it. It should not exist. But to be fair, I probably should focus more on ones that we have both seen. So out of the remainder, a movie I would never want to see again, and I'm sorry, Christian, you're probably going to be slightly pained by this, but Xanadu. Xanadu is terrible. It really, I don't know, too much neon, too much hairspray.
Too much early 80s.
And too much nonsensical plot. And I don't mind a good nonsensical plot. This is a bad nonsensical plot, though.
It's so nonsensical, it's nonsensical. Like.
Yeah, so but Xanadu can roller skate off into the neon sunset.
Whereas I mentioned very earlier on, is it's one of those movies I've always been quite familiar with. So I don't know. It's like trying to take a movie away that you're quite familiar with when you're a kid. And even though I didn't see this lots when I was a kid, I'm very familiar with Xanadu now, that it exists. I enjoy it when I watch it. I have been known to pull it out of the cabinet and watch it a few times without the podcast being an incentive. but I definitely think, probably I wouldn't put it up there with Grease 2 as a guilty pleasure with Xanadu, but I definitely would lump it in with those kind of guilty pleasure type movies like Xanadu, Can't Stop the Music, and, what's the other one? What's the third one? The musical? Oh, and Grease 2. Sorry. Yeah. I'm being overwhelmed by their 80s-ness at the moment, and I'm getting confused. But no, I definitely think the three of those movies are very much so sort of guilty pleasures that I enjoy watching. I think very much the fact that they're musicals, but I can see, Trevor, how you couldn't like it. You wouldn't like it too.
Yeah. No. And of course, the Star Wars Holiday Special, again. Yeah, if George Lucas ever finds that sledgehammer, I'll join him in the hunt to smash it out of existence quite happily.
Yeah, and I'm sure there'll be a lot of people that would be in agreement with that too. And it's definitely an oddity, whether it can be lumped in with a movie or even, you know, the redeeming features quality. I mean, segment, but I definitely think that it needed to be mentioned. A lot of people don't know of its existence, and I love revealing it to diehard Star Wars fans, and the looks on their faces, almost along when they kind of light up going, oh, wow, I haven't seen that. And you almost want to make them watch it and make them sit through every excruciating 90 minute of it.
This hurt me. I now want it to hurt you.
Exactly. So I do have great pride in mentioning it. It was funny because when we did the last podcast and, you know, a few posts on social media that we were talking about the holiday special, it's interesting seeing people go, oh, wow, what's that? And the other people going, oh, God, you mentioned it. How dare you mention it? It's almost like Fight Club. You do not speak of the holiday special.
Mm-hmm.
So, but we have brought it out into the open. We need never have to speak about it again, Trevor.
Absolutely. So, well, I think that we have pretty much summed up the last year of redeeming features quite nicely there. Being that we have now got a full year of podcasts ahead of us, we've got quite a few bad movies to watch. So hopefully all you listeners out there will join us for the ride. I'm sure we can dig up some absolute pearlers in the coming months.
Sure, I wouldn't be, just between Trevor and I'm sure we can find something really out there and awesome to start off the year for the first one. So listen in a couple of weeks. But but yeah, I'm sure there'll be some interesting titles. But again, we won't be so we won't lump a few things in, like we were very unfair this year with some titles that we put in, but I'm sure there's gonna be some others that we can find that generally I like Blood Rain. Ladies and gentlemen, we need to find another Blood Rain so Trevor can stop mentioning it.
I may have a few ideas to folks.
I do or do not look forward to that.
Yeah, listeners out there, if you have any suggestions before I start madly compiling a list, and I'm sure Christian will as well, see if we can outdo each other this year. Who can pick the worst of the worst? Let us know. We're definitely eager to hear what you think should be looked at.
Definitely. So he's on to 2015, and may we never speak of the movies that we've referenced in 2014 ever again.
Absolutely.
To some extent. Let's start afresh. So I look forward to it, Trevor.
Absolutely. Going to be fun. Thanks, Christian.
Thanks, Trev.
Just had to do a quick little warning about the interview that's coming up. This was one that took ages to put together, so I really had to take the opportunity to interview our very special guest for this first podcast of the new year when the chance came up. Essentially, it was backstage after a show at Lena Mullane's School of Arts. So it does get a bit noisy at one point. And essentially, just to warn you in advance that you will be hearing some clanging and some background noise. Aside from that, though, it really is a great interview. Enjoy.
It looks professional, doesn't it?
I feel like we're Harry Potter in a cupboard.
Yes.
Under the stairs. Indeed. And it's Christmas, and we're going to get coal and tissues and...
Pretty much, yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, well, I'm here with someone I've been trying to talk to for quite some time, but the problem is she has got to be one of the goddamn busiest people I know.
I'm sorry.
That's all right. Crystal Ahrens writes, teaches, acts.
Directs.
Corrects my pronunciation for me.
Teaches accents.
Goes to Melbourne and performs at the Fringe Festival.
Yeah.
And also happens to be, aside from all of that, a clown.
Yes. I am a clown.
I really don't know how she finds the time, but I do know that if anyone decided to spy on us and see our Facebook Messenger chats, they would see how much fun we've had in trying to put this together. So, we've kind of taken the moment to find a quiet corner and hide away. Probably start a few rumours, that's always fun. And finally talk to Crystal Ahrens. Thanks so much for talking to the Rufus Project.
No problem at all. It's my pleasure to finally be here.
It's so glamorous.
In a glamorous, weird alleyway behind a establishment somewhere in Brisbane.
Yes, Brisbane. Pretty much.
Yeah.
Okay, well, yeah, so after that, I mean, it's hard to know where to begin, but I've got to admit, though, since I started seeing your clown page and your clown stuff, I have you wanting to ask you a few questions. Because funnily enough, there's been a few things that I've spotted up. First of all, I saw very major prominent stories actually talking about clown shortages, particularly in the US and the UK.
Really?
There was a big thing about how there's a clown shortage and not enough people are taking up the mantle and the red nose.
Yeah.
I mean, what is the clown scene like in Australia? Because I could not find any information about that.
Okay, so I am a Brisbane artist, and I know a couple of Brisbane clowns that do a lot of work, but a lot of them go down south to do work. I know there's a lot more happening in Melbourne and Sydney. In Melbourne, there's a Melbourne Clowns group that meets and jams every now and again, and we have a Brisbane clown group as well. I just haven't been able to get to jams because I've been so busy. So I got to jam a couple of times, and then I was like, oh, clowns, I am so busy. I will be there as soon as I can. But in terms of Australian clowns, and a friend of mine who directed me in a show at Woodford, Hayden Spencer, is an amazing clown, and he works with Cirque du Soleil. And there is another amazing clown who worked with Cirque. I can't remember his name. I'm so sorry. But he did Varakai with Cirque du Soleil, I believe. And Hayden did Duralion, I think. So, yeah. Excellent. Very knowledgeable, I think, and I believe.
Fair enough.
Yes.
Cool. So looks like clowns are good in Australia. That's good to hear.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they're getting employed internationally, which is comforting to know.
Okay.
Maybe it's because of the shortage in the US. Maybe we're overrun with clowns and I just haven't met them all. But I've been training a couple of them, so it's nice to see them starting to grow their little, you know, clown blossoms and move out into the world, which is, you know, a nice thing as a teacher to see that.
Oh, lovely, lovely. I wasn't too sure if it maybe was part of it, but I also noticed that, again, in the press particularly, there were a few stories about creepy clowns hanging around. And then American Horror Story came along.
Yes, yeah.
With its horror clown thing. Yeah. And I believe there's even a remake of It.
No.
In the works.
No.
What is it with clowns that tend towards this creepy horror stuff?
Well, I think it might be the unpredictability of those scary clowns, and that behind a clown there is an adult hiding in there, and you don't necessarily know whether to trust that adult or not. I know when I perform in clown, I have to earn each child's trust and each audience member's trust, whether it's in a party or on street performing or in front of an audience, basically. You have to come out and show them that you're a safe clown almost, which is why I kind of work without a mask per se, because a lot of kids see the clown face of like the August clown and they immediately freak out and get intimidated and scared. Similar thing happens with Santa as well. It's an intimidation by the bigness or the glorified nature of the mask. They're not used to seeing that character all the time. So when they do see it, they're like, oh, is it something that I'm allowed to see? Is it safe, essentially?
Yeah, actually, good point, because I've had the pleasure of being Santa a couple of times.
Yeah.
So, they were actually taking it from the kids and just trying to get their trust, yeah.
And a lot of parents, you know, note for the parents out there, for young players, when you approach a clown or when you approach a Santa or a big character such as a suited character, sometimes you're giving that child a certain amount of trauma by just pushing them at them when you know they're crying or you know they're scared. It can help if the parent acknowledges it, or you're a bit scared, oh, we'll take our time, you know. And we are there, we're performers, we're willing to wait for the kids to be ready, so we're happy to take the time with you, honestly. But when the kid's screaming and yelling and says, I don't want to be near this suited character or this clown, then probably take it away, because we're the ones that are going to get beaten up at the end end of the day and have someone screaming our eardrum out, which is always fun.
So that's probably where the fear of clowns come from. Go to the clown!
Well, I think it starts with the parents because they get so excited that they're going to see that suited character or they're going to see that person performing that the parents go, yes, please get a photo with Santa or please get a photo with this clown. And then the kids automatically go, oh, it's too much. It's too big. And then the closer you get to something, the bigger it becomes. So then that's where the fear breeds in. Well, that's what I've noticed in performing anyway.
Oh, hang up. Pause.
Sorry, it just... because we want to put chairs away. Thank you. Okay.
Is it the other way? That's a big clanging.
This is great so far. Okay, so... moving on from the clowns.
Yeah.
Could get a bit noisy here, the guys, so we'll just keep on going. Again, moving on from the clown stuff, particularly, I know that you went down to the Melbourne Fringe Festival with a bald prima donna.
Yeah.
I couldn't quite work out, I mean, what was your involvement with that particular show?
Yeah, I was an actor in the show.
Yeah.
So I played Mrs. Martin, which she's one of the lead characters in the ensemble who her and her husband rock up to the Smith's house. And, of course, the insanity unravels as the night progresses and they're each trying to hold on to the craziness of the moment with language and they can't find the words to express how they feel anymore. So basically it's an unraveling of these people as the night progresses, and then in true Ionesco style, it's in all its loving absurdity, the play starts again, but as Mrs. Martin, as Mrs. Smith, changing at the end of the show, so it presenting its cyclical nature basically of the piece.
Oh, nice.
Yes.
And what is the Melbourne Fringe Festival like? I mean, what?
It's incredible. It is such a beautiful festival, and it was lovely to get to spend time seeing other clowns perform. Basically, I spent a lot of time at other clowns' shows. Friends of mine that have gone off to Goliere and done their time and are creating their own works now, which is such an important part of Australian theatre and Australian clown.
Excellent, excellent. And I think because we are running out of time here, I think we're going to be kicked out of this backstage area in the not too distant future. So just moving on and... also, the teaching,
yes,
is also quite fascinating. I mean, what so drew you to that side of things, and what really got you into the teaching of others to do all these cool things?
People always told me from when I was like 10 years old, oh, you should teach. And I never understood it, and I never wanted to, because other ignorant people came up to me and constantly said, oh, people who can't do teach. So I therefore got a negative stigma in my head of I mustn't be able to do it, and therefore I must teach. And I didn't, therefore I stayed away from teaching. And then as soon as I became adept enough at clown and acting and accents, then I was like, I feel comfortable passing on the knowledge now, and I really want to give back to my community, and I want to help younger artists who are in their early days and struggling to get into a university or struggling to be seen by the artistic community, and I want to help them pave the way and make their own work. Like, people helped me get there, you know. Without lovely people in my life and lovely mentors, I would never have gotten to this stage of my career so far. So I'm really grateful for that time that I had, and that I was nourished by older artists and mentors. So I think that was what drove me towards teaching, because it's not easy when you're starting out and you wake up one day and you say, I want to be an actor and there's nothing else I want to do. And then it's about, how do I make a career of this? How do I make it sustainable in this present time, in our current financial climate, basically? What can I do to serve the world, really? So I look to inspire young artists every day that I teach, and encourage play in my work, because I love the clown background and I love failure. And I always tell my students, you know, fail. It's the most important thing. And there was this great quote that I heard, and it was, yes, it is a failure, but how good of a failure is it? And I always carry that with me, and I go, like, tonight, for example, You know, you just saw me on stage and I know I failed many times, but I enjoyed the failure and I made it into something new and something brilliant and no one knew it existed. And so it grew into something amazing. And that's my job, is to make failure into joy and to encourage artists, go, it doesn't matter if you make mistakes and it doesn't matter if you fail, you're going to get up again and you're going to do the show again because you love acting and there's nothing else you can do. You can't be an accountant and you can't be an engineer because you're just not wired that way. And for me, that was really important to find out and discover that I'm not wired to anything else. I'm terrible at maths and I always laugh when actors say I can't do maths and I'm like, we don't need to do maths, like, you know, get an accountant.
We can act like we can do maths.
We can act it, yeah. I can act like an accountant, but no, really, get an accountant. Yeah, so that's what I'm driven to do, to make sure other people have opportunities that I didn't have. Because when I auditioned for drama school, I auditioned many, many times, and people think, oh, it's so easy, you get in the first time, and it's not. And it took me, I think, a long time to get in, and they told me each year, they gave me these criticisms or feedback, and one of them was, you can't act, why did you come here, you can't use your body, you can't use your voice, like, why did you even bother? And that made me go away and reevaluate and go, yes, I can. And it drove me to be like, I can, with the right training, the right mentors, I can get there. And then I went back 3 years later and I wowed them and I got in, you know. So perseverance, discipline, all those things. It's important to teach your students and to pass that on and let them know that this is a long rant.
That's fine.
Let them know that even if they feel like everything's hopeless and even if they're failing, they're going to make it just from pure discipline and hard work. And that's my long spiel. Full stop.
Wonderful spiel.
I hope okay. It made sense. Sorry.
It certainly did. Now, this also could be a long list, but if people out there want to check out the clown stuff or the teaching stuff or the acting stuff, where can they go?
Where can they go? What do they do? So at the moment I'm teaching down at the coast for New York Film Academy. I'm also teaching for Brisbane Arts Theatre. They do Saturday morning classes for children, so it's good to chat with them. If you can't go to that one, there's Monday and Wednesday nights for Brisbane Youth Theatre as well. They're fabulous. And gosh, I sometimes do classes for Lena Marlina's doing practicing stagecraft and joy in the space and how to fail and be successful in failing. And gosh, oh my gosh, where do I end? Clown Play is my kids' entertainment business. So we come and do kids' parties at your house or a park or wherever you need us to come. And we've got two legal Queensland rabbits, legal. I have a license for my rabbit babies. And you can check them out on Clown Play and see updates from the rabbits. And soon there will be a rabbit show of sorts, a clown rabbit show about how Queensland is racist against rabbits. So that's coming in the new year. Yes. Sounds Stay fair. Tuned to Clown Play for more information. Facebook.
Yep, I will put links down below to make it easy to find.
There's so much I'm doing. My head's everywhere right now. Sorry, guys.
Well, like I said, this has been a long time coming. So glad we finally had a chance to chat.
Yes,
this has been fantastic.
You.
So, Crystal, thank you so much for talking to the Rufus Project.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Oh, it's all very exciting. We're screening Russ Meyer's 1965 cult drive-in classic, Faster Pussycat Kill Kill, at New Globe Theatre on the 16th of January. Now, with a plot line like this, how can you resist? Three strippers holding a young girl hostage come across a crippled old man living with his two sons in the desert. After learning he's hiding a sum of cash around, the strippers start scheming on him. Following the movie screening at 6:30 p.m. on that night, we will have live music from The Plastic Bangs, Burlesque by Miss Bertie Page, and DJ Will Be Trash. Now, this is all only $12 for the movie and a whole night of entertainment going right through until midnight. We have one double pass to give away to one lucky listener at The Rufus Project. Hit us up on Facebook to enter the competition.
Thanks so much for listening to The Rufus Project. We hope you enjoyed listening to it as much as we enjoyed putting it together. And look, we want to hear from you. So whether or not you want to comment on something that we've talked about, enter that competition that Christian announced, or just give us some general feedback, please do. Find the Rufus Project on Twitter, on Facebook, on YouTube, on Ustream. All wonderful, wonderful places to give us feedback, or even go to our iTunes channel and leave us a review there. We would love to hear from you. You can also head to our homepage, therufusproject.podomatic.com, and put the comments there as well. Like us enough to wear us or drink from us? We got the Spreadshirt store at therufusproject.spreadshirt.com.au. Check it out. Buy something if you like. No pressure. Please buy something. And if you, or someone you know, or if you know of an upcoming event that you would like to have featured in our local wildlife section, we definitely want to hear from you guys. Send us an email using rufusreviews@gmail.com and let us know, or of course, send us a comment any other way. And now I'm going to try something a bit different with these next few podcasts, and that is to find a moral conclusion to what we've just listened to. So I think the moral for this particular podcast is, please don't discriminate against the bunnies. They're cute and fluffy. Thanks for the inspiration, Crystal, and I'll see you all next time. Tiny gags, the ant-sized gags I've been doing for this Ant-Man teaser trailer, it just made me think of one thing and one thing only. What is this?
A center for ants!
I mean, if Marvel can actually work in Zoolander references to their future promotion of Ant-Man, they will have me sold. Oh, wouldn't it just be glorious? If you could see me now, you could see that I'm doing Blue Steel.